I'll call the meeting of the February 19, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all time. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outburst or clapping. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles. If accommodations are needed, communicate with sergeant staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant-at-arms staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Steer, have you read the minutes?
I have, and I move to approve the minutes.
Representative Steer has moved to approve the minutes. All in favor signify by saying
aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and the minutes of the February 18, 2025 meeting are approved. First meeting to come on the agenda today is House File 124. Representative Byrd, come to the testifier table with your testimony. Representative Berg is a member of the committee. Do you want to move your bill before the committee and recommend on elections, finance, and government operations?
Yes, thank you, Chair. And I do have an author's amendment. Would you like me to move that now?
That's the next line.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Novotny, for hearing this bill and also for your flexibility. So the A1 amendment adds a section to the underlying bill authorizing a political subdivision to receive a gift on behalf of one or more public safety officers and distribute it to the intended public safety officer recipients in the circumstance in which a public safety officer employed by the organization was killed in the line of duty. The amendment allows a political subdivision to establish policies in accordance with this. It also allows a local government to fundraise and expend funds for funeral or memorial services in the event of a line of duty death, including travel to national memorial events for public safety officers within a given time. That's the amendment.
Representative Berg moves her amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Mr. Chair. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, it's the DE2. Just wanted to have clarity for the record. Amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Moeller. Is there any discussion on the DE2? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the DE2, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carried and the amendment is adopted. Representative Byrd, begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think everyone here is familiar with the tragedy that happened in the city of Burnsville on February 18th last year. I'm particularly grateful for the support and kindness of many of you in this room have shown our community. I know some of you feel this deeply on a personal level and are grieving in your own ways. I wish you peace and healing. In Burnsville, we have come together as a community to share the journey of healing with one another. Along the way, the city has received generous donations from individuals and organizations to provide support and resources to the families of our fallen and the police and fire departments. Current gift laws for local government do not address our unique situation, however, making it difficult to accept and distribute these gifts to the intended recipients. This bill, as amended, would authorize gifts to public safety officers under a narrow set of circumstances in the event of a line of duty death. The bill authorizes political subdivisions to receive gifts under these narrow circumstances and distribute them to the intended public safety officer recipients, and authorizes political subdivisions to establish gift policies. This bill would also authorize a city to fundraise and expend funds for funeral or memorial services for a public safety officer killed in the line of duty, including travel to national memorial events for public safety officers killed in the line of duty within a specified time frame. While I do truly hope that what happened in Burnsville never happens in another community, this bill is written to apply broadly to local government should they experience this. I have worked with the city of Burnsville to draft the bill before you that is asking for clarity and flexibility in receiving and distributing gifts under these very specific set of circumstances. With me today to testify to the bill is our fire chief, BJ Jungman.
Testifier, please state your name and give your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me today. My name is BJ Jungman. I'm the fire chief for the city of Burnsville. My colleague, Police Chief Tanya Schwartz, could not be here today and she sends her regrets. As you likely know, we experienced a horrific tragedy just over a year ago on February 18th, 2024. In an incident that took the lives of three of our fellow public safety servants and wounded another. Following this tragedy, we had an overwhelming outpouring of support from the community and the public. We are very grateful for this support. While the support has been much appreciated, we have found under the current statutes, it has been difficult for the police and fire departments to be able to accept and use the donations to support our healing. This has left us looking to alternative means such as outside foundations to fundraise to send staff to national memorials. These donations would help provide opportunities for our staff and the fallen families to heal together. This bill would allow for the acceptance of donations and public purpose expenditures for 24 months following a line of duty death for an agency. We hope that no one ever has to use this statute, and we hope that this helps anyone that experiences the loss of a colleague. We appreciate your support in paving the way to help agencies in the future. I appreciate the time today, and I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, Chief. Is there any questions for the testifiers or Representative Berg? Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Berg, for the bill. And thank you, Chief, for being here today. Our hearts truly do break for your team and for the community of Burnsville. So I'm happy to support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Berg or Rep. Chief.
Committee members, we appreciate that. We appreciate the support and the kind words, and the outpouring of support has definitely been noticed, and thank you for your support in this.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Representative Berg, for bringing this bill forward. Obviously, I signed on to it because I think it is going to do some good for the communities that we all represent if there is ever a tragic incident. Fire Chief Jungman, thank you for your servant heart and leading your group through this. And I know Police Chief Schwartz, the same thing. The leadership has been incredible. And through this tragedy, I think you guys are shining a light on something that was a big problem. I think it was a couple days into it, you guys started to receive overwhelm and feel that support. And it's your community coming around you, and it's tough to kind of push them away. So thank you for bringing this bill forward. Very supportive.
There's no other questions. Representative Berg, closing remarks.
Thank you so much. We had a memorial in Burnsville yesterday to mark the one-year anniversary, and something that our police chief, Tanya Schwartz, said hit me. She said, what happened does not define us, but what it did do, I think, was bring us together in a way that we didn't expect. And in discussion on this bill with Representative Witte, who signed on as my co-author, you know, we really talked about this, you know, it's like we've got a Republican author in the Senate and he and I authored it over here, and it's like it's nonpartisan. And Rep. Witte and I agreed this is nonpartisan. This is a human issue. And this is something that in one way or another touches most of our lives. And so our community is really grateful for the opportunity to bring this before. I'm personally very grateful, too, so thank you, Chair and Committee.
Rep. Representative Berg renews her motion that House File 124, as amended, is referred to Elections and Government Operations Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and your bill is re-referred to Elections and Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Berg and Chief Drumlin. Next bill on the agenda is House File 541. Representative Sear, testifiers table. Note that we have two testifiers that will be appearing via Zoom. For clarification, Representative Sear, is this your first time presenting a bill?
Yeah, thank you for that extra layer of stress, Chair.
You speak into the mic.
Thank you for that extra layer of stress. I appreciate it.
Representative Sear, begin your testimony.
All right. Chair Novotny began his work on this bill about 4 years ago, meeting with law enforcement use of force trainers and talking with psychologists and law enforcement leaders. The goal of this bill is to provide professional police officers education for peace officers in service training on the proper use of force, including deadly force, the duty to intercede, and the duty to de-escalate. House File 541 appropriates $2.5 million to the Office of Higher Education for reimbursement grants to post-secondary schools. The college must satisfy satisfactory requirements on deadly force and firearms requirements. Use scenario-based trainings that simulate real-world situations and involves the use of real firearms that fire non-lethal ammunition, including training on physical and psychological effects of stress, including training on de-escalation methods and tactics, bias motivation, defensive tactics, and force-on-force training, and be offered to peace officers at no charge to the peace officer or law enforcement agency. Colleges that offer this training are reimbursed at a rate of $450 for each officer who completes the training. I apologize, I'm feeling a little under the weather, but I do have two people on Zoom today as testifiers. We have Andy Rooney, Interim Director, Professional Peace Officers Education Quarter, a coordinator at Alexandria Technical College, and Tom Draper, Director, Professional Peace Officers Education Coordinator, Hennepin Technical College. So we'll start off with Andy Rooney.
First testifier will be Mr. Andrew Rooney from Alex Tech. Mr. Rooney, testimony. Mr. Rooney, do you hear us? Mr. Rooney, do you hear us?
While we wait, is it true that I have to bring treats for the...
Is this your first time?
Yes, it is. I didn't know if it was a joke or if it was actually... Okay. So I should have? My apologies.
All right. Sounds like we have Mr. Rooney online, and I see you have someone with you. Could you, if Mr. Rooney, you're going to start out, begin your testimony. State your full name, begin your testimony.
Sure. Andrew Rooney with Alexandria Technical and Community College Police Training and Education Program.
And Rebecca Swanson, faculty member for the program as well.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for inviting us here today to speak on this proposed bill. As you know, training revisions happen in law enforcement all the time and is ongoing. This continues to be true of the revisions made over the course of the past few years, especially or more specifically after the events of 2020 and 2021. The changes and the focus and the direction of our training have come in the forms of legislative review, statutory updates, as well as Minnesota post-board training requirements. These new training policies and procedures have been adopted by the approximately 543 law enforcement agencies through in-service training, as well as the 29 professional peace officer education institutions in the form of pre-service training. Training can be offered as a part of this proposed bill, would include scenario-based training for all ranks, all jurisdictions, simulating real-world situations and involving the use of force training with training ammunition or simmunitions. This would, in turn, add an element of stress and reality to the training, having to make decisions under these simulated stressful conditions. And this would also provide for the officers in these departments a more realistic experience. In turn, it will help to assist officers to better prepare to make decisions in real-life situations if they are called upon to do so. One particular area of focus as part of these changes may very well be to Minnesota Statute 626-8475 as it relates to the duty to intercede and to report excessive use of force. Minnesota State Statute requires that an officer, no matter the tenure, no matter the rank, intercede when they observe a violation related to the authorized use of deadly force, taking into consideration the totality of the circumstances involved, or the use of force that is otherwise beyond that, which is objectively reasonable under the circumstances. The regardless of tenure and rank requirement of this statute may make an officer of lower rank feel uncomfortable when interceding with a person of a higher rank or even an officer from another department. As officers are taught to respect and follow lawful directive of those in positions above them, however, this is not the consideration under this statute, and additional training could assist these officers in feeling more comfortable when they're making these decisions that are required of them. Scenario-based training and the resources required are already being used in pre-service training in higher education, and the proposed bill could provide agencies, their leaders, and their officers with in-service training options in a controlled environment. Again, attempting to replicate that high-intensity, no-rank decision-making requirement that other delivery platforms may not be able to provide. For example, an online platform is acceptable for delivery in some content, but it's hard to bring the stress and realism to training when you're on a computer. The numerous professional peace officer education institutions located around the state, there would be an opportunity for departments to find a training facility option within close proximity. In addition, this bill would also assist in alleviating budgetary hardships of our professional partners. Some of the costliest parts of training are facilities, equipment, and staff to fulfill these requirements. As a former chief of police, I'm all too familiar with the effects that more training and a little additional funding can have upon a department's budget. And now as a police training director, I believe that the bill will allow our state professional peace officer education institutions to once again team up with our professional partners in law enforcement to provide this in-service delivery. In conclusion, this bill could provide a cost-effective scenario-based training option for departments in collaboration with their professional peace officer education partners to provide high quality training that all officers and communities in our state deserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Rebecca Swanson going to be doing any testimony, or is she just available?
I'm sorry, she's just available.
All right, and we'll move on now to Mr. Draper from Hennepin Tech.
Hello, everybody. Tom Draper from Hennepin Technical College. What Andy just spoke of is, in fact, very eloquent, and what we are proposing to do with all the PPOE coordinators, what is great that we can do throughout the state is standardize a training that can be performed at the 10 different PPOE sites throughout the state so that officers can get training that is beneficial to them at an optimal price for the agencies and through this grant. But we would put together a team, as we talked back in 23, to put together a standard course of training that would be able to be put out throughout the state. And as Andy said, we have the equipment, we have the buildings, we have the facilities that this can be carried out in. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Draper. Questions for the testifiers or Representative Steer? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, really not a question, just a comment. I really appreciate the structure of this, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just thinking about this because of some hearings that I've been in the last couple of days, that, you know, rather than there being a particular post-secondary school coming and saying, hey, we want to offer this or whatever, I think this is fine. Like, this is a statewide need. This would create a program to say, hey, we want to make sure that officers throughout the state are receiving this training. Post-secondary schools apply. And I just sort of, I'm appreciating that structure, I guess. And it's not just in this committee, it's some other committees as well. Just trying to think through how can we identify problems and then create structures that will meet those problems as opposed to an individual organization or somebody coming to us, and just trying to think more strategically. So I perspective, not to say that I necessarily support this in the end, given the budget situation. So we'll just have to see where the money lines up. But the structure of it, I appreciate. So thank you.
Any other questions for the testifiers or Representative Witte?
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Representative Steer, thanks for the treats. I know you're nervous, so. So how would the money part go out? And then as it, you know, is it based on a need? Who figures those pieces out?
I think the money piece would be put out at $450 per officer. So it'd be a regional training offered in a few different locations. So it would most likely go out in an email to the chiefs and have officers sign up for it. So you'd have five or six from one agency and five or six from a different agency going to this regional training. And then it's dispersed back at $450 per officer. So the only cost to the agency would be the time that they're investing, but the training itself would be free to the agency. So any free training is always good for law enforcement. We always try and do as much as we can to keep our budgets low and keep taxes down.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Steer, you run a smaller agency, and what's your average budget per year for training?
The average budget for my training, I think it's about $47,000. And then you have every 5 years you have a pursuit training, which costs a lot of money, and every other year you have first responder. So depending on what year that the budget cycle falls on, the training budget is typically gone right before it starts. So the elective trainings that we have, officers that want to better themselves in a specific field, like SRO, for example, those are on the sidelines. And sometimes they get it in 1 year, sometimes they get it in the second year.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Blitz.
Thank you. So how many officers do you have under you?
I have 12.
About 47,000 for 12 officers. That's not a lot. I ran a smaller operation, not police officers, but I had a $60,000 budget for 10 people. So that doesn't go very far. How, in your opinion, how much should we be allotting for police officer training per staff?
Representative Steer.
Yep. Well, in the past, there's been a $6 million budget that's been given out to police departments for reimbursement through the post board. I think that bill is going to come up at some point in time, and I'll 100% support that. That gives us a little bit more money in the training fund so that we can do the mandated trainings that we have currently. Well, if you ask any of my officers, they're going to want to go to every single training that comes across our desk. It's just what they want to do. But the mandated trainings themselves, it costs a lot of money. Patrol Online, that's a costly. And then you have like True North, that's another cost. And then sending officers to training, overnight trainings like DMT, for example, you know, that's a 3 or 4 day training at the BCA in St. Paul. So there's a lot of travel, a lot of shift coverage, overtime to fill those or backfill the shifts. So to give you an actual dollar figure, I don't know. That's a tough one.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Durant. No? Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Steer, for bringing this bill. I want to know a little bit more about the instruction for physical and psychological effects of stress before, during, and after a traumatic event. I know Representative Witte mentions this often, just the fact that there's over 850, I believe that's the number that you cite, critical incidents that a police officer will experience throughout the course of a career, and that's a lot. It's a lot to take home. I'm sure I don't have to tell you that. Talk to me about what that training kind of looks like.
Representative Steer.
All right, so to try and mimic what happens in the field in a training scenario is always difficult. What we try to do is get, like, the officers will have them do push-ups and sit-ups to try and get their heart rate going. We do small, short runs. They will, like, fight a bag for a while or something we can do to get their blood pressure up and then try to reenact the scenario. But what we don't get in that is the adrenaline release that comes with it. So I think the more scenario-based training that we can have officers do, and then, you know, in this particular bill, you have officers from, say, Walker, Minnesota, and they're teamed up with an officer from St. Cloud. So they don't know each other. And it talks about the duty to intercede, which I do think is a good bill or a good law. But when you pair those two people up, you may have a size difference, you may have veterans difference. So a one-year officer is supposed to intervene with a 30-year veteran in a high-stress situation. So it's something that you have to do now by law, and we hope that they do, but that just doing that alone could be difficult.
Representative Ingalls.
Thank you. That's extremely, that's good to know. I didn't know any of that. I want to know kind of what you guys do after the fact, though. There's a traumatic incident that occurs. How do you cope with that stress? What mechanisms are you guys using for that?
Okay, so I can answer this. When I first started, you didn't do anything. Your sergeant told you to go home and deal with it. Now we have a different generation, and we are realizing and bringing to light the mental health issues that we face every day. Cops have it's an interesting job. I mean, you go from doing absolutely nothing for a little bit, and then you're in a high-speed pursuit, and next thing you know, you're going to a domestic, and you may be delivering a baby. I mean, that all could happen in the same exact shift. But how do you deal with it at the end? We have peer support training. I know the Chiefs of Police Association and MPPOA, everybody's pushing peer support. Everybody's pushing mental health. And it's a big thing in our profession now. And just taking away the stigma, mental health is important. It used to be that no one talked about stress, no one talked about mental health when I first started, and now that's all it talks about. So we deal with it a little different now, and I think it's probably the right way to go.
Representative Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. We've supported this in the past, and many of our members had a chance during a couple interims ago to actually tour Hennepin Tech, and then I think the chiefs did some of the experience, the use of force training, the virtual training. I was terrible at it. So I really appreciate the training that goes into this, clearly a lot more than just the one time we were there. I do have a question of whether or not this will return to committee. I understand it needs to get moved on to higher education now, but because it would potentially count against our target, is the plan for it to come back here, Mr. Chair?
That is correct.
Thank you. I have no other questions and plan on supporting the bill so we can keep it moving. Thanks.
Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. I have a quick question for Representative Steer. I know there's all types of different trainings that officers are involved in. How do you kind of prioritize them as far as what's mandated and what's optional?
Sure. So the mandated training is something that we have to send every single officer to every year. It's mandated by the Post Board, so the Peace Officer Standards of Training Board, and they hold our license. And this legislator, this body, sets the parameters for what trainings we have to go to. So it's the CLEO's job, the Chief Law Enforcement Officer's job, to make sure that the training is completed every single year. Use of force, firearms, those are a guarantee. You have to do it every year. Low light situations for using the firearm, that's a requirement. And then the trainings outside of that, once you figure out how much it's going to cost per officer per year, then you can pick out the elective trainings. So say you want to send someone to like DARE school, that's a significant cost and hotel stays. So that you have to plan ahead for that. And the request for training is a lot. Some officers are more tailored to SWAT training or tactical training, while others are more into the negotiations training. So you just kind of pick and choose as much. If you do see a deficiency in an officer that is coming up brand new, you want to send that officer to maybe report school or search warrant class. So you just want to make each of the officers as good as they can be. So if you have one that's lacking, that's the one that gets the training the most, and then you just go on from there. Hopefully that answered your question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
We have a technical thing that was picked out. Fiscal person Walsh has something that he'd like to point out.
Mr. Chair, it was just brought to my attention that the appropriation was made for fiscal year 25, which is the current year and ends June 30th. And so were this bill to pass, you probably want to amend that to make it for fiscal year 2026.
So we'll pick that up and amend that when it goes to higher ed and get her fixed before it.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine with an oral amendment now if you want to do that.
Having never offered an oral amendment, having watched.
You can do it.
All those in favor of the.
Yeah.
Nonpartisan state clear amendments.
Okay. Mr. Walsh or someone from nonpartisan could just state what the verbal amendment should read so that Representative Mueller can make that amendment?
Mr. Chair, the amendment would be on page 1, line 6, delete 2025. And insert 2026.
Representative Mueller, would you like to make that motion?
I will move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mueller moves that on line 1.6 in the space where it says fiscal year 2025, change 2025 and insert 2026. All in favor of this motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment, verbal amendment carries. Anyone else? Representative Schwartz.
So Terry, you had mentioned before that the budget's usually gone when you guys are getting ready to train. So did you guys have to pay that out of pocket, or can you explain that to me?
Well, we don't encourage. We don't encourage officers to pay for it out of pocket, but some of the officers that do decide to do it on their own, they can sign up for their own training and pay it for it out of their own pocket. Obviously, they can't use a squad car or using any of our equipment when they're doing this, but we try to get as much bang for our buck with the trainings, with the budgets that we have. Free training is always good, like I said, and this training would be a free training other than hourly wage and squad car use, but we do what we can. Obviously, more funding would be better. The future $6 million bill that's going to come forward is definitely a priority for me, and I know the chiefs and the sheriffs and MPPOA back that bill 100%.
Thank you. Another question, Representative Schwartz?
About, because you had mentioned a couple different classes. How much are those actually, like a couple $100, a couple thousand? Do you have like estimated on how much those cost?
Sure. So like first responder, for example, that I think it's $500 per officer. So you take that by 12 officers. And if anybody has EMT, that's a little bit more expensive. And then for your sergeants and above, if they want to go to a leadership class, those are anywhere from $500 to $1,000 for a week training. I know like FBI LEADA, I think that's right around $900 for one officer for a week of training. There's a series of three, so that's whatever, $2,700 to get the series done. So that's usually done over a period of 3 years. You know, some training, I don't think there's, the lowest training you're going to get is about $100.
Thank you.
Representative Steer, closing remarks.
All right, closing remarks. So I think we've said a lot already. I think any training that we can give to law enforcement where the cost is covered by the state, I think is important. We've covered the fact that our budgets are not large when it comes to training, and this kind of reality-based, scenario-based training where we can put officers under stress and have them in a deadly force situation using non-lethal firearms, I think would be beneficial. I would urge your support on this bill.
Thank you. Before we go to the vote, I'd like to thank the testifiers. Thank you for taking your time out to be on this Zoom today. And Representative Steer renews his motion to move file 541 before the committee and recommend that it is re-referred to the Committee on Higher Education, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion carried. Thank you to the testifiers and Representative Steer. Representative Steer also has the next bill, which is House File 340. Representative Steer, would you like to move House File 340 before the committee and recommend that it is referred on transportation, finance, and policy?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
There is an A2 amendment to this bill. Is that your amendment?
Yes, it is, Chair.
Could you explain your amendment?
The A2 adds the same 4-year license revocation for disobeying traffic laws while fleeing a police officer as fleeing in a culpable, negligent manner. A2 also deletes a section in the bill dealing with the tracking devices. That bill will come up at a later date by its own.
Are there any questions for Representative Steer of the Amendment A2? Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we just received notice that the new fiscal note came in, maybe hot off the press, on the fiscal note. And I just want to clarify that with the amendment, the note remained the same. If we can keep going and pass the amendment, just wanted to get that information.
I believe an amended fiscal note has been requested, but Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair and members, I was notified today the fiscal note was being pulled to add in rulemaking costs, which were in the original fiscal note. The new fiscal note has the same amounts of money as the original, but is 2 pages longer, and I have not yet determined what the 2 pages encompass.
Going to transportation for one. I'm sorry, was there a question?
Mr. Walls answered my question, and I'm prepared to vote in support of the amendment.
All right. Is there any other discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion carries. Representative Steer, with the bill now in your desired form, please begin your testimony.
All right. Over the last several years, the number of instances for fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle has dramatically increased. In 2023, there were 2,262 agency-initiated pursuits. Law enforcement officers have experienced the correlation between a rise in fleeing and an increase. According to the BCA crime report that was released in August 2024, there were 15,612 stolen vehicles in 2023. That's a nearly 30% increase from 2019 when there was 11,410 vehicles stolen. This bill aims to address these concerns and work towards minimizing the amount of fleeing instances. Fleeing a police officer in a motor vehicle is already illegal. The first 4 sections of this bill would amend the existing statute 609-487 for fleeing a police officer while in a motor vehicle by adding two offenses and raising the penalty by an additional year of fleeing while exercising culpable negligence, is guilty of a felony and may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 4 years. Current fleeing violation is at 3 years. Fleeing while failing to obey signs, signals, or markings and or failing to keep on the proper side of the road is guilty of and may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 5 years. The final section, section 5 of the bill, would allow officers to utilize, I'm sorry, I'm not going to, that one's trucking, so don't read that, I guess.
All right, do you have some testifiers, Representative Steer?
I do. I have Shane Myrie and Imran Ali from MPPOA.
Who will be first? Welcome back to committee, Mr. Myrie, and please begin. Please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Shane Myrie, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, or MPPOA. Thank you again for keeping the issue of fleeing front and center in the committee and for the opportunity to testify here in support of House File 340 as amended. MPPOA has recently testified in this committee on current trends that we have seen on the streets regarding fleeing from police. That ranges from a single occupant fleeing from a traffic stop all the way to groups of individuals getting together, baiting law enforcement to chase them while they flee. But today, I'd like to take a minute and talk to you about an incident that recently happened on the streets in Minnesota. Since MPPOA has testified here in this committee last, which was about a week ago, on fleeing, on February 12th, which is a week ago today, in the metro area, a group of individuals in a large pickup truck fled from Robbinsdale Police and additional law enforcement agencies from Robbinsdale into the St. Paul area and then back west on I-94 into Minneapolis, all during rush hour traffic. It's my understanding that this is still an active and open investigation involving multiple law enforcement agencies in the metro area. But I'd just like to point out what I was quickly able to pull from local media headlines about what's going on the streets in Minnesota. WCCO, suspects escape after ramming multiple vehicles during Robbinsdale police chase. Another article from WCCO, stolen truck rams through rush hour traffic. And then Star Tribune, the article's headline was, "I don't want to drive for a while," says motorist hit on I-94 by suspects in a stolen vehicle. The first sentence in that article reads, "At least 8 drivers were hit as suspect weave in and out of rush hour traffic Wednesday in Minneapolis." Mr. Chair and members, you've heard it many times, but fleeing suspects have created a public safety crisis on our roadways. With regard to this bill in the Minnesota Criminal Code, our membership does believe adding language like this in House File 340 to cover actions that go beyond simple flee, but don't raise to death, gross bodily harm, or substantial bodily harm is good public policy for Minnesota. Like was stated earlier, this would address the situations where a fleeing vehicle leaves the roadway, drives through a city park, ends up driving the wrong way on a road, or going into oncoming traffic. And in closing, as this bill moves forward, I know in this chamber and in the other chamber, there's multiple bills that are going to be moving forward. But from a law enforcement standpoint, I'd also like to point out that we may be at a point in time where the state of Minnesota, whether it's through the Office of Traffic Safety or elected officials or whoever would do it, needs to develop some sort of public safety messaging campaign about the dangers and consequences of fleeing in a motor vehicle. We've done this in Minnesota in the past, and it's been successful. We currently have public safety messaging campaigns on seatbelts, click it or ticket. DWIs, drive safe, or drive sober, drive smart. Texting and distracted driving, hands-free Minnesota, park the phone. We now, potentially, as these bills move forward in parallel with the public policy decisions you guys make, it may be time for a statewide messaging campaign on fleeing from police as well. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Myrie. Next testifier, state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Imran Ali. I am the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association General Counsel. For those of you that do not know me, I'm also a former prosecutor as well as a former defense attorney. This issue is near and dear to me, and the increased penalties that have been outlined by Representative Steer fall in line on some of the trends that we're seeing on our Minnesota roadways. But what I want to do is very briefly focus on why this is happening. And I have an ability not only in my position or my positions in the past, but also just as a citizen in Minnesota and talking to other citizens as well. Let's be honest. There is a negative view of law enforcement in our state and in our country. And this has only gotten worse over the years. Many elected leaders across Minnesota and across our country really provided some fuel for this. Whether it's the defund the police movement, whether it's some of the rhetoric that we've seen come out, whether it's on social media, or whether it's in a form of the op-ed, we have a negative view of law enforcement, and this is providing some of the fuel of what we're seeing on our roadways today. There is no regard for the law. There are no consequences. These people that make the choice to evade law enforcement are thinking of the following. Do I flee or do I not flee? This is a risk-benefit analysis. I have yet to see a case in all of my years as a prosecutor and all of my years as a public defender in Hennepin County where I either had a client or I had any evidence that has come forward in any case where the suspect said they meant to flee because they wanted to. This is a risk-benefit analysis that each of these people that make that decision, and we've seen an increase in that decision to do so. Here's what they're thinking. They're thinking, in this calculated risk, do I have a warrant for my arrest? That's going through people's minds when they make the decision about whether to pull over or not to pull over. Number two, part of the calculated risk, do I have any contraband in my vehicle which could lead to further criminal liability? Oftentimes, when you see a felony flee case that is charged out by the county attorney, you often see another charge as well, and that's assuming that the individual was apprehended. And lastly, the individuals will say, am I under the influence of any alcohol or controlled substances, which likely could send me to jail? That's the calculated risk that these individuals face, and quite frankly, what I have seen, especially in the last 3 years, is these individuals that choose to do so fear no consequence whatsoever. There is no consequence to flee when fleeing a peace officer in a motor vehicle is the lowest level severity crime in the state of Minnesota, but yet is the only crime that affects every single driver, all the way down to Laverne, all the way up to Grand Marais. It affects every single driver. And what our legislature has done has said this is the lowest level felony. And what we've seen as a result of this, we have seen increased deaths, increased injuries, and also increased liability to officers. But the unintended consequence is the grave risk to public that exists. And so what I would ask the esteemed members of this committee and Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Steer, for this bill, is that give prosecutors the tools to utilize different levels of fleeing depending on what happens. And please, please do not wait for somebody to die. Don't wait for the general public and people that are driving on the way home from work to die. We saw it happen in Minneapolis, off of Lake Street, where five young women who were traveling to celebrate Eid a Muslim holiday, were killed. We cannot wait for citizens to continue to die, whereas the other individuals that continue to not obey the law fear no consequence, have no consequence, and as a result of it, make us all less safe. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Steer or his testifiers? Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in general, I agree with this bill, and I'm glad you brought it forward, right? I have two young children who walk on the streets of St. Paul, and I am terrified regularly of what might happen on those streets and how they how speeding cars, regardless of whether they're fleeing police or not, I mean, you know, it's dangerous for them. And so I want to recognize that. But I also think it is unfortunate that we are coming to this place to talk about this in a way that is presuming that we understand why people are fleeing law enforcement. Because I live and represent the district where Philando Castile was killed. And that was an innocent man, a lawful gun owner, who was killed when he was pulled over, shot in front of his fiance and his child. And so there are a myriad of reasons why people might flee the police, including the fact that they might die. And I think that if we do not recognize that as a real fear for a number of people in my community, in particular black and brown individuals, but not exclusively, I think that we're missing a whole segment of what is happening. And so I think it's really important that we take a moment to recognize that we all have work to do. We have work to do on our side to make sure that we are giving folks the tools they need in order to better prosecute, in order to hold people accountable when they do bad actions. But we also need to recognize that there is a problem when a officer of peace can kill an innocent person in their car. And that is still fresh in the minds of the people in my district. So I just want to recognize that. The other thing that I thought was really interesting about the testimony here is, you know, I'm a lawyer, and I can tell you most people don't know what the laws are. They don't know when we change us, you know, fleeing from the police and change it from a misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor or anything like that. They don't have a recognition of that, and they're not thinking about that when they are driving. And I think you said it best, right? The things they're thinking about is, do they have contraband? Do they have a warrant out for their arrest? Those are the things that are going through their head. And so I actually really appreciated what you were saying. I'm sorry, I forgot everybody's names. I'm so sorry. But I really appreciated what you were saying about an awareness campaign, because I think that is potentially more impactful than changing what the actual law is, because people don't know what the law is, and they're not thinking, oh, this could really get me some serious time. I better not speed away from the police. Maybe they are thinking that. Maybe these two things go hand in hand. Maybe we increase penalties and have an awareness campaign. But I think to your point, like, if people don't know that this is going to get them in big trouble, they are not going to stop doing it. And it has to become, like you said, click it or ticket. It has to become almost second nature before people recognize that this is something that I really need to think twice about. And, you know, I'll be honest. I think most of the people who are fleeing police are probably not really in their right head a lot of the time and are not thinking super clearly. They're in fight or flight mode, which is unfortunate. And it does create danger for the entire community. But I just want to recognize those two things. We absolutely have to do education alongside with increasing penalties if we're going to do that. And then second of all, we have to look at all sides of this and the fact that statistically, for some people, when they get stopped by the police, it can be a life or death situation, even when they do everything right. Thank you.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of questions. I think Representative Hollins put some of the concerns I had with the testimony very well. You know, this, in the years I've been at the legislature has not defunded police. We've actually funded police at quite a large level. And so I don't know if that was sort of trying to take a dig at us, but just want to make that very clear. I also want to make it clear that there are consequences under the sentencing guidelines. In the fiscal note, which I know is getting updated, It says from 2019 to 2023, there were 3,336 sentenced, an annual average 667 cases. I think we can definitely talk about whether we need an additional culpable negligence or some other grades of this offense. I think that is a very fair, logical argument to make, but I just want to make it clear that there are many cases where people are being held accountable. If people think it's too low of a penalty, that's, I understand that, but people are being held accountable for this offense. I do have some questions about the bill language, and I am specifically looking at your Section 3, Subdivision 3B, and I'm looking first at lines 2.2 to 2.29, and I guess I'll just make a comment here that some of those additional subdivisions are covering some things I'm not sure were intended to be covering, like flash driving through like a flashing pedestrian signal, that sort of thing. So I feel like there might be a little more refinement on that one. But the one that gives me a little bit greater pause is on line 2.30, where fails to keep on the proper side of the road in violation of 169. I took a look at 169.18, and it covers things like following a vehicle too closely, slower vehicles, passing stalled or disabled vehicles, you know, drive on right, pass on left, that law. And so it also covers driving down the wrong way of a one-way lane. So I for sure understand you would want to stop that particular behavior, but I'm not sure you intend to cover all of 169.18. So I guess my first question is, would you be open to taking a closer look at exactly the kind of driving conduct that's listed here in that section and considering maybe really refining it a little bit?
Representative Steer.
Yeah, Representative Miller, I'm always willing to take a look at that. We are trying to hit a specific target of what they do. I mean, we have a lot of law enforcement officers that we can poll and say, what is it that they're doing? We obviously didn't mean to cover that whole statute, so it definitely is cleaning up. My goal here is to work on both sides so that we can get this thing across the finish line. We have to do something in Minnesota to stop what's happening. And I know Representative Mueller and I spoke offline about this, and it was we talked about the messaging campaign. We have to get the message out there. It needs to be jails and prisons. It needs to be cops on the street talking to kids that they know are going to flee and saying, hey, this is no longer a slap on the wrist. There's a penalty, but now it's an increase. So we have to find a way to get that messaging out there. This bill can't just hit, like you said, it can't just hit the floor and become law and nobody knows about it. So messaging. And we got to work together to get this thing crossed the finish line.
Representative Steer, that sounded like a great closing remark. Do you have anything else?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm not done. Thank you. Well, I certainly appreciate that. And one of the things I heard that your testifier mentioned was this car that was hitting other cars. And I didn't see that in this bill. And I thought maybe that would fall under the culpable negligence. But, I mean, that was a good example of something that maybe want to think about adding if it doesn't fit the culpable negligence definition, and then agree with you on the messaging. Because we know that the fiscal note has been revised, has a little more depth to it now, I don't know that the numbers have changed for our committee, but I also want to make sure that we're able to give this the full consideration when we have our budget targets. So, Mr. Chair, is it your intention that this would come back to this committee?
Sorry, I was distracted. It's coming back to the committee. It's going right now to transportation, and have plenty of opportunity, and Representative Steer is committed to working with you on fixing it. It'll have to come back with the new fiscal note.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
That's all you have. Representative Steer, closing arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just would urge support in this. I think we've talked enough. We have to do something to slow down or curb the fleeing vehicles in Minnesota. It puts everybody at risk, like Mr. Ali said. I think that's it.
Representative Steer renews his motion that House File 340, as amended, be referred to the Transportation Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and your bill is referred to Transportation. Thank you, Representative Steer. Mr. Meyer. The last bill on our agenda is file 962. Please take the gavel.
Chair Novotny, do you want to move House File 960?
I do.
It is my understanding we'll be laying. Is that correct, Chair Novotny?
That is correct. We had submitted a request for the language of the D1 that was originally brought up. Then fiscal staff notified, or nonpartisan staff notified us afterwards that they would have to make some changes to the language and do change some of the classifications, I believe, is the work that needed to be doing. Some of the things need to be broke up more.
Thank you. And I see you have a DE1 amendment, and I understand your testimony will be on the bill as amended with the DE1. Is that correct?
It is on the DE1, and the language after it's fixed, as I said, for the laying it over will be the same, just changed in the classification or how it's broke up.
Hold on, man. I also see there's an amendment to the DE1 amendment coded A2. Who offering that amendment? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we last year started hearing about this concern over Brady Giglio, and I know we'll hear a lot of testimony about that today. And it seemed at the time that it was, and it continues to be the case, that it's a really complicated issue involving constitutional issues, case law, ethical obligations of prosecutors to disclose information to the defense. Obviously, the defense bar has an interest, and I know law enforcement has an interest as well, because there's lots of different sort of interpretations of the law across the state with consistency, and then concerns about officers if they're with their own employment. So I understand this is a big issue, and we had talked last year about putting together a task force because this is such an issue involving so many stakeholders. And I was sad that some of the stakeholders decided not to move forward. Some were working with us on a task force, but others decided not to move forward with that. And I think that's unfortunate because I think a lot of this work could have been done in the interim. But I do still think it's a good idea to move forward with a task force at this point, especially in light of the fact that even now this bill, the DE was given to us yesterday, right before we had committee. It's apparently not done yet. Again, a lot of complicated issues here, and I just think it makes the most sense for us at this point in time to create a task force of all the experts who can really dig in.
Thank you. Chair Novotny, do you support this amendment?
I agree with many of the things that Representative Mueller said. I do agree that this needs to be a collaborative work, and that work is going on right now. The basic premise of the task force is going on right now. It was going on this week. It was going on this morning. And the truth of the matter is this bill, the task force bill that I first proposed, this language has been around. This is now the third session that it's been there. And just speaking with the stakeholders from all sides, we'd like to get this settled. That is the emotions or the feelings that I get from talking to the stakeholders, be it the county attorneys or the sheriffs or the MPPOA or the County Attorneys Association. And it's just something I think we need to get done. And the task force would kick the can down the road another substantial part of time. And I think that we just need to get this going and get it done. And my goal with this legislation and the amendment that I have is not to adversely impact the Constitution or other obligations of the county attorneys or ethical responsibilities. I think we have the ability with the groups and the stakeholders that are working right now to get this done. So for that reason, I would recommend a no vote on the amendment.
Thank you. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I you know, appreciate that, but I don't know that there's been a lot of collaborative work on that. I understand the county attorneys perhaps had a meeting this morning about this. I don't know if the defense bar has been looped in. I don't know about the city attorneys either. This impacts their work. So I'll continue to support this amendment, and I would ask for a roll call.
Thank you. Any other discussions? Not seeing any. Roll call has been asked. The clerk will take the roll on the A2 amendment.
Novotny?
No.
Witte?
No.
Mueller?
Aye.
Berg?
Aye.
Bliss?
No.
Curran?
Aye.
Guerin?
No.
Engen?
No.
Feist?
Aye.
Greenman?
Aye.
Harder?
No.
Hollins?
Aye.
Hudson?
No.
Johnson?
Aye.
Pinto?
Aye.
Bream?
Aye.
Rapinski?
No.
Schwartz?
No.
Steer?
No. Okay, so seeing 9 ayes and 10 nays, the amendment does not pass. Now back to the underlying D1 amendment. Chair Novotny, I assume you wish to adopt the amendment and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Witte. I have been, as I said, working on this. The proposal's been around for at least 3 years, and there have been many conversations in the past, and as I said, I've been in contact with representatives from all the stakeholder groups and have commitments to work on this with all the rest of the stakeholders, and I firmly believe that before this goes to the next committee that we will have an agreement by all the stakeholders. I have two testifiers with me. The first will be Mr. Ali again.
Okay. So we're going to vote on the amendment. All in favor adopting the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Novotny, you can explain your bill now.
Thank you. As I said, I'm sorry, I apologize for jumping forward on you there, Chair. My first testifier will be Mr. Ali.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Novotny, as well, for this bill and esteemed members of this committee. Again, I know it's repetitive, but my name is Imran Ali, and I am the Minnesota Peace and Police Officers Association General Counsel. Again, I find myself in a unique position. All of my testimony that I have given at this public safety committee over the years, whether it's in capacity as a general counsel for MPPOA, in a capacity for the County Attorneys Association at the time, or in the capacity as a prosecutor, has always been nonpartisan. And it'll continue to be that way. Because my testimony on any of these subjects, including this important bill, is done not to dig anyone or not to provide any sort of one way or another, but just to talk about the facts and talk about my experience. And obviously there are a lot of people in this committee and other people that will testify that have a lot of other experience as well. But I do think I'm in a unique position, members of the committee, because I, again, have over two decades experience of being a public defender in Hennepin County. During that time, I made requests for Brady disclosure, and then later as a prosecutor for 10 years, over 10 years, dealing with Brady Giglio, understanding the implications, and also providing that sort of disclosure. Currently, right now, I'm also in a private law firm that does municipal prosecution. So I'm still involved in some way, shape, or form. My testimony today, members, is going to really focus on a macro level. And then I'm going to end with just a few examples that are in Minnesota. And I can tell unequivocally that we have a problem. And I think Representative Mueller, on the amendment about a task force, I mean, that this has been going on now for 3 years, and I followed it very closely. And the fact that we're even talking about a potential task force or that this has been going on in this legislative body for 3 years just shows that we have a problem on our hands. Under the Constitution, due process requires the prosecution to turn over evidence favorable to the accused and material to one's guilt or punishment. This requirement includes evidence that may be used to impeach a prosecutor's witnesses, including police officers. When the reliability of a given witness may be determinative of to guilt or innocence, non-disclosure of evidence affecting credibility falls within the rule regardless of whether or not it's been held in good faith. Brady information must be disclosed to the prosecutor. The prosecutor must then decide whether to disclose the information to the defense. And if possible, however, that information may not be admissible in court, would then move to the other argument. It's only the evidence which the court finds to be relevant for impeachment purposes that can be used. This is something historically, I would say, that has been an issue predominantly for prosecutors. And as a prosecutor, I can tell you that there is nothing more, I have no more fear than losing my law license over the fact that I do not have a piece of evidence that has been disclosed to me. That's a real fear, and I understand that. But what has happened in the last few years is that police officers at times have been subject to what I'm going to call the weaponization of a Brady Giglio designation. For organizational purposes of my testimony, and I'm assuming for questions that will follow thereafter, these are the issues that are present today. Number one, there continues to be an inconsistency of what constitutes material or relevant information. Two, there is inconsistency in the argument that a prosecutor would or would not make whether or not that information is relevant. What does that mean? There are different counties that are interpreting how to handle Brady material and how to make the arguments in court. I have heard of examples in Minnesota where there is an item or evidence that is determined to be Brady, and that Brady then is disclosed to the defense as required by the law. And rather than the prosecuting authority making the argument whether or not that should be relevant or admissible into trial, that second phase does not occur. And so there's inconsistency in the application of whether or not then even an argument is made on the district court level about whether or not that information is relevant. Number three, Brady lists, data, spreadsheets, whatever it is, we know that there is data that's out there. Some individual agencies, law enforcement agencies, some county attorney's offices, they classify it as a Brady list. Others classify it as data. Some people say we have a spreadsheet full of data. Any way you cut it, there's an inconsistency about this information that's being held by whatever party decides to hold that information. Number four, there is an inconsistency on how private data is stored, disclosed, and handled. And this is involving predominantly non-sustained complaints or complaints that fully haven't gone through the process of an internal investigation. Number five, how the private data given under a protective order, which many county attorney's offices are doing currently right now, what happens after that disclosure is done to the defense bar, and what sort of concerns are being assuaged to ensure that that private data is held strictly for the purpose of that one case and one from the defense bar's own client. Number six, notice given to the officers. I'm aware of at least two instances where peace officers in this state were subpoenaed to testify at a trial and were informed prior to their testimony that they were on a Brady list. They had never been given any notice, whether it's from the police department, who, by the way, in those two situations says they weren't given notice as well. There's inconsistency among not only within counties, but also in our municipalities that have the prosecution. Number seven, there is no due process or mechanism for law enforcement officers impacted to refute the designation and or provide more information. There currently is no appeal process. Here is what this bill does. And again, just all of us in the committee, of course, have the bill. Without going through the entire bill, I just want to sum it up into 3 points for purposes of time. Number one, this bill hopes to achieve and create consistency and application amongst all prosecutors, not just the 87 county attorneys, but all of the municipal prosecutors that work in Minnesota. Number two, it is there to provide protection for an officer that they cannot be disciplined solely for their Brady designation. This is important, again, as we'll see examples of how Brady, or the designation of one on Brady, is being weaponized. And three, it provides a framework for how an officer can ask for reconsideration or the use of a district court ultimately to handle the issues should they arise. These discussions have been ongoing, as I stated earlier, at the Capitol for the last 3 years, and every day that goes by where our officers are not afforded due process, I truly believe our justice system will fail. I will give you two examples, and these two examples are from the last few months.
Ali, can you make those 2 points pretty quick?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The first one is in Hennepin County. In Hennepin County, there are guidelines from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office that differ from a local prosecutor, a local city attorney, in what is Brady and how that should be disclosed, or what is Brady and whether or not that's relevant in a case. This case specifically deals with property inventory and a policy of property inventory that resulted in an investigation that found that it was unfounded. In other words, there was an allegation that property wasn't inventoried. The internal investigation found that that was not wrong. It was an issue of how that was inventoried and was it inventoried correctly. There was a disagreement between the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and the local municipal prosecutor about whether or not that was Brady, and that case resulted in going to the district court, and the district court solving in Hennepin County. Judge Scoggin ruled through an order essentially sided with the city attorney in this case, adverse to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office policy on Brady Giglio. And very briefly, the last one is a case, and I think this is really important, and I hope members of the committee hear me out in this. There's a case in which I'm currently representing a police officer. The police officer was the affiant in a search warrant. This certain police officer relied on information that was known to them, provided that information in a warrant. That warrant was signed. And subsequently, after individuals were charged from the contraband that was seized at the home, there was a Franks hearing, a motion for a Franks hearing. And for those of you in the committee that don't know what a Franks hearing is, generally speaking, that's where there's a material misrepresentation or there's a material omission in a search warrant. So it's a pretty big deal. And as a prosecutor, I've handled several of those, what we call Frank's hearings. As a prosecutor, what I would do is I would review a defense memorandum, see exactly what is either was a material omission or what indeed was something that was wrong or something that was a material misstatement, and I would view that very serious. In this particular case, what ended up happening was there was no evidence that was offered at the hearing. There was no testimony from the officers. In fact, the officers that were involved in this found out 6 months later after an adverse court order came out. And again, the court, the district court is just relying on the limited information provided by the prosecutor. And now we have this district court order out there that indicated that this officer made material misrepresentations in a warrant. And as a result of it, the officer was given notice that he is now on the Brady list. No due process. None. No process to go and challenge in district court, because there is no mechanism, because that case was dismissed, and within a short period of time, 6 months or a long period of time, it was found. So I know I'm out of time, probably over a few minutes, but I wanted to give those two examples just to highlight why we need something in place, and we need it in place soon. Thank you.
Thank you. We want to get to all the testifiers who came today and any questions for them. We're running up against our end time, and we can resume member discussion when we bring this bill back. So if our testifiers can limit it to 2 minutes, I'd appreciate that. Next up, Kevin Beck, and on deck is Jeff Potts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In another life, I represent a client. I work closely with a lobbyist named Roger Aronson, and so I'm used to ceding most of my time to speak. So I will be brief. I am here to just talk about one real-life example of an officer whose 20-plus-year career was ended solely because of a Brady designation. He was designated Brady by a county attorney who was newly elected. Coincidentally, he had campaigned for her opponent. 5 weeks after she was sworn in, she designated him as a Brady officer and said, "We will review your cases to decide on a case-by-case basis." The city said, what were the reasons for it? The three reasons were two incidents that happened 14 years prior and one incident that happened 19 months prior. And during those 14 years and 19 months, this officer had testified for this county attorney's office, for the municipal city office, for the assistant U.S. attorney in the U.S. attorney's office, and for a neighboring county attorney's office. And they had never designated him as a Brady officer. Unsatisfied with that, the county attorney then said, "We will dismiss every case that this officer is on, and we won't charge new ones." City pushed back and said, "Why?" The response they got back was, "I've made my decision. I'm not changing it." City had no choice. They fired him. They said, "We don't have a place. We're a small department. We have no place to put him. We arbitrated it." I'm a labor attorney. We arbitrated it. The arbitrator effectively said, "I can't second guess a county attorney's decision on Brady. I'm not in a position to do that. My authority derives from the contract, so I can't get into that. And he doesn't meet the duties of a police officer, so discharge is upheld." And there's no vehicle to challenge that. There's no vehicle to challenge this, clearly, in this case, a politically motivated decision with personal animus towards an officer. The current chief, the previous chief, both testified he was one of the best police officers they'd ever worked with. He had 22 years on the job, and it ended just like that. And he had no recourse. And I would say one other case, I did try another one where we tried to challenge this through a court of appeals mechanism, and the court of appeals shut us down and said these decisions are not quasi-judicial. And so what these employees, public employees with a constitutional property right to continued employment, have no due process mechanism. And that is what, from my perspective, this bill fixes. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Jeff Potts, on deck, Bill Hunt. And when you get up there, can you just state your name?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Potts. I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, representing the nearly 300 police chiefs across the state. I'll be brief. We appreciate the bill. Thank you to the author. We have been engaging with stakeholders. recently, as recently as this morning. We have engaged with stakeholders throughout the last couple of years on this issue. Our goal here in trying to resolve this is to, you know, gain consistency. We heard Mr. Ali mention a number of different areas, a number of different, you know, issues related to Brady Giglio and the inconsistencies that are occurring. Our membership is very this is a very high priority for them. I think it was item number six, Mr. Ali's list of seven or eight, that, you know, one area that we would like to kind of continue working on, and it may be in a version that's just wasn't quite ready for the hearing today, is achieving some consistency and notification to the officer or the employing agency when it's been determined that there is a Brady designation applied to an officer. We want to continue working on that. We also do very much appreciate the engagement with we do anticipate additional conversations on this. We really appreciate the progress that's been made here so far. You know, this session, it's a very high priority again for the Chiefs Association to try to get someplace where we see more consistency across the state as we deal with this Brady issue. That's all I have on this bill here today, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Up next, Mr. Bill Hunton, and on deck, Brad Johnson. Focus the one you dug to when you were.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill Hutton from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. Chief Potts says he was going to be very brief. That wasn't very brief. I'll save you a couple of minutes here and just say the Minnesota Sheriff's Association supports this bill, and we're eager to continue to work towards this bill getting across the finish line that was stated earlier in the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Brad Johnson, and on deck, Kevin Magnuson.
Mr. Chair, members, I hope it's all right if we do that in reverse order. Not real good at following instructions. Well, thank you for this opportunity to testify on a topic that is of extreme importance to prosecutors and law enforcement alike. We asked for a meeting with the law enforcement stakeholders, and we had that meeting this morning. It was very productive, and we are committed to continue to work with them to address these concerns, you know, in the best way that we can. And we had a good exchange of ideas this morning. And we understand the problem that they're facing. I mean, this is existential for them as it is for us. And so we are really aligned in, I think, more ways than might seem from some of the information you may have read in the press. I was going to go through the terminology and the topics, but I think we're going to skip that, and we can send you that in writing if you'd like. I do want to say that a lot of the things that we're seeing here and the examples that we heard are very serious, and they're a sign of a system that's not working. You know, when there is trust in good procedures between local law enforcement and prosecutors, these situations don't arise. You know, maybe I'm fortunate in Washington County, but we do not see these kind of problems. You know, the law enforcement is quick to provide us with information, and we are quick to let them know what's going on. There is a lot of information flowing and not a lot of disagreement on what ends up happening in court. One other point I'd like to make is that this bill, and I think the public discussion, starts with the premise or the idea that there's a Brady list. And everything starts from this idea that you have a list or you should have a list. I don't have a list. The Department of Justice doesn't have a list. The entire federal criminal system works out without a Brady list. The requirement from the Supreme Court is that you have a system of record. And so you have data. You don't have a list necessarily. Some people do, and that's fine. There's so much more at stake than a list, because a list only gives you maybe some names. What matters is the data that underlies it. And that data may be relevant. It may not be relevant depending on the case, depending on, you know, what the charges are, what the facts are. And so while it would be great to have more continuity across the state, I don't think you're ever going to see it where it's going to be just lockstep and there's going to be a single set of directions that are going to make everything simple. This is incredibly complex. The breadth of what we're talking about here is enormous, but the depth with which you need to go down on each situation is also enormous, and that's going to lead to some incongruity. The area that I think is, and I'll leave you with this, I think the folks for law enforcement that testified earlier are absolutely right. The fulcrum here, the hot point is non-public data that is required under Brady Giglio. The problem is we don't have any guidance from the Supreme Court as to exactly what that is. The Data Practices Act requires that the existence or status of any complaint, I mean, that is public data, right? So as soon as there's a complaint made against a law firm, that is public data. But then the case materials and other things that they are using in the investigation is not public data. So then at what point does it become material, relevant, and it goes to the guilt or innocence of a defendant, so it needs to be disclosed? I mean, that is where we should be focusing our time and trying to come up with some ideas, I think, that would advance the project here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Up next, Brad Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, may it please this committee, my name is Brad Johnson. I'm the Anoka County Attorney. The reason that I've been asked to come here today is that I am currently the leader of the MCAA, the Minnesota County Attorneys Association work group on Brady Giglio. I want to give you all some insight or a window into what's involved in that process. The work group includes county attorneys from Sherburne County, Anoka County, St. Louis County, Carlton County, Stearns County, Kandiyohi County, Olmsted County, Blue Earth County, Travers County, and others can participate as the needs direct. We have monthly meetings. There have been drafting sessions that have gone on all day to deal with this issue. Really, we decided to refocus the association on in 2024, in early 2024, even before some of the things that were coming before this body in 2024. Through that process, we have involved input from our own justice partners that are law enforcement agencies or other stakeholders that have worked with us. And more recently, we've involved the associations, MPPOA, LELS, the chiefs, the sheriffs. We've discussed shared concerns and we've discussed frustrations, many of which we've already identified as issues that we have recommendations for. My colleague and friend John Hollitz, who's the chief deputy county attorney up in St. Louis County, told us as we were all getting into this process that we were about to embark on the five stages of grief. And for those of you that don't know them off the top of your head, they are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. And so I would just share with you that I view us as being in that kind of area where we are talking about general acceptance on a lot of policies that have been discussed. And the reason that you have this diverse makeup of county attorneys that are involved in this is because it needs to be administered. Best practices need to develop in counties that are large, small, and medium-sized. And there are different districts and there are different counties that are approaching this way topic in different ways. And that's not to say that they're doing it bad or they're doing it even inconsistently. They're doing it effectively for how it works for them. And candidly, I think we've benefited from some of those best practices. And so what we're developing is an approach that can be used statewide within the existing legal framework of the Minnesota statutes. So without changing the law in significant areas, there are ways to deal with this. And I want you all to know that MCAA is committed to continuing its collaborative efforts with our justice partners and all the stakeholders that we met with this morning. But in this process, it is important to remind everyone here that it is the responsibility, the duty of the prosecution function in our criminal justice system, the ministers of justice that are entrusted with carrying out justice in each and every one of our counties, to handle this. And the county attorneys at the MCAA must be leading this effort. Courts have described this duty as a self-executing prosecution function. That means it's on us, regardless of what a legislature does. And that's what the Supreme Court has said. That's what the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility has said. And that's where we have it. And I want you all to know that we have taken over this issue because it is bigger than just one county attorney's solution to a problem. I will tell you that I have confidence in the process the MCAA has undertaken and in the relationships with our justice partners who we work with today and are on a good path toward finding a path forward that will result in better and indeed best practices and procedures in the future. And with that, I would turn over the rest of any time that we have left to John Hollitz from St. Louis County.
Thank you. Up next, Jonathan Hollitz.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of this committee. Thank you for hearing us out late in the end of the day. As my colleagues have shared with you, we're hard at work. MCAA is hard at work. We've been working on this. We are working with our partners. What I want to tell you is, and this comes on the heel of some of the testimony that we've already heard today, I want to tell you some things that you won't see in anything from MCAA. You will not hear anything that comes out of the MCAA that says that Brady is an avenue that prosecutors can prevent people from testifying. That's not what it's for. That's not what it's supposed to do when it's done right. That will not come from the MCAA. That's not what Brady empowers prosecutors to do. We're supposed to seek, review, and disclose data as required by the Constitution. That's it. That's what we're supposed to do, seek, review, and disclose data. You're not going to see a policy or a suggestion or best practices from the MCAA that says prosecutors should recommend termination of public employees or the prosecutors have the power to have some adverse employment action on public employees. That's not what prosecutors are supposed to do when Brady is done right. We're supposed to seek, review, and disclose data. That's what we're supposed to do. We don't have the authority to fire anybody other than those that work for us. And we don't want that authority. That's not what we want to do. It also isn't supposed to be a naughty list or a scarlet letter that ruins somebody and does so indiscriminately and does so without transparency. You're not going to see that from the MCAA either. Again, we're supposed to seek data, review it, and disclose it. And that's what we're supposed to do. So that's what we're hard at work at doing. As County Attorney Johnson said, we feel that we need to be, because it's our obligation, we need to be leading the way on this. And we're working hard at it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions for any of our testifiers? We will have member discussion when the bill comes back up. Not seeing any questions. Chair Novotny, do you want to make a very brief closing comment?
I will make a very brief comment. I think that as we get down this process, that the updates to the language through amendments will come together, and know that I am committed to ensuring that the final bill accomplishes the goals of those in law enforcement who care about due process, notification, and also the goal that the public has confidence that the criminal justice system is run with integrity. And I give my commitment that we will work with this and work with all the stakeholders going forward to come with the best.
With that, House. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just heard Chair Novotny say all the stakeholder groups, and I certainly hope that when you talk about all the groups, you also talk to the city attorneys, the state patrol, the BCA, because they have investigators, and the defense bar as well, both the public defenders and the private defense attorneys. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Novotny.
Goes without saying.
With that, House File 962 is laid over. Our next committee meeting will be on Tuesday, February 25th at 3 o'clock p.m. There being no more business before the committee today, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.